This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Google announced yesterday that it's developing an operating system for PCs that will be tied to the web browser it released last year. The operating system will be free. How can companies give things away on the web, yet make a profit? That's what Chris Anderson tries to answer in his new book, Free. Anderson is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. In Free, Anderson says that despite giving most of its services away for free, Google has found a way to become one of the most profitable companies in America. Chris Anderson, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to look at how free could actually be a good business model?
You know, it came from this reflection on the paradox that is our modern age. It seems like almost everything online is available for free in one form or another. And yet we're trained to believe that there's no such thing as a free lunch and you get what you pay for. And in this confusion over the meaning of free and the economics of free, I thought there was something changing, and that deserved a deeper look.
You know, you talk about the paradox of free, that people are making lots of money charging nothing. Give us an example of a company or a website that succeeds in doing that.
Well, you know, the idea that you can make money from giving things away is, of course, the media business model dating back to the beginnings of broadcast. Radio is free to air. People are listening to this for free. Television over broadcast is free. And the idea that media could give away a product to consumers and then make money from a third party, the advertisers, is, 100 years old or more. What's happened online is that we've started, as we moved online and the underlying digital economics allowed you to give away things for free because the costs were very low. The first thing we did is we just applied that traditional media model of throwing ads against it. And then Google got smarter, and Google built a whole company around very clever ads. But it was still the same model. A third party subsidizes you, the consumer. What we're now seeing, especially as the recession has diminished the advertising pool, is we've had to invent a new form of paying for free. And that's something called freemium, where a tiny minority pays for the majority. That the free version gets you huge scale and millions of people, where the premium form gets you a few really engaged ones who pay.
Give me an example of what you mean with the freemium.
Yeah. So, I mean, an example might be the Wall Street Journal as a website. You hear often that this is a tectonic debate over free versus paid in the newspaper industry, with the Wall Street Journal, flying the banner of paid and the New York Times currently free. And in fact, what you see with the Wall Street Journal is that it uses both free and paid. Some of the most popular stories are free. If you come at it via Google News, it's free. But as you get into some of the more niche content, it becomes paid. As you get into the archives, it becomes paid.
So you see this as a new model in online use, that you get in the door for free, but once you're in the door, there's things that you might have to pay for and other things that you can continue to access for free.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is the first really new business model I think we've seen out of the internet. The others were largely projections of 20th century models. Freemium is an inversion of the old free sample. So, if you go to a department store, you'll get a spritz of free perfume, or if you go to Starbucks, you'll get a bit of a cookie or a muffin. And those ideas, those free samples, are you give away a couple percent or less as a sampler to drive demand for everything else. Online, it's just the opposite. You give away 80%, 90%, 95%, even more for free, because, again, the underlying costs are so low in digital stuff. And then that free achieves incredible recognition. It's very easy for people to try it, and that becomes a form of marketing. And rather than telling people how cool the product is, you let them try it. And then some fraction of them say, that's terrific, but I want more. And then you have something more to sell them.
So are companies actually making a profit doing this?
The Wall Street Journal does make money on its website, and it's not clear that all newspapers could follow that model. It's clear that a really unique and high quality provider, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Economist, etc., they seem to be able to do this quite well, which is that they're offering something distinct. The problem with the internet and getting paid is not so much that we made a mistake 10 years ago and let the genie out of the bottle and said, ooh, websites should be free. The problem is infinite competition. There's so many other places out there. If you don't make something free, somebody else will. And the only way to charge for it is if you have something truly unique that people value. The Wall Street Journal makes good money off its website because it has unique stuff. If not the front page, then the metal commodities trading or whatever it is you're particularly interested in. I think we're seeing the games industry, which a lot of people think is trivial, but is actually the most exciting laboratory of free in the world right now, is one that we've switched from, you know, buying a box in a store for $50, which for, you know, an Xbox game or a PlayStation game. And as it moved online, first in Korea and then in China, it went to a different model. It went to free to play and then convert some fraction. And the same thing with the iPhone apps. As, you know, right now we're seeing the iPhone apps come in two forms, typically a game. It'll be the free and the paid form. Nothing particularly new about this, but this is becoming on a global scale because we have the internet's ability to distribute things for free across the world at no additional price. That has allowed us to take these kind of small free sample forms and turn them into global markets based on free that then make money off 5% or 10%.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Anderson. He's editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, and his new book is about new models of giving away or selling information through the internet, and it's called Free, the Future of a Radical Price. Let's talk about the Google model. Now, Google, as you point out, has like 100 different things that they're offering now, and the parts of Google I've used anyways are all free. You pointed out before that they're still using an advertising model, but they really developed a very sophisticated, mathematically complex system of matching advertisers and users. Would you talk a little bit about the model that Google helped create for advertising?
Yeah, the old model of advertising, and that's the world I'm in, with Wired and Wired.com, and I work for Condé Nast, and so we're a big magazine publisher, Vanity Fair, Vogue, etc. That model is based on the notion of we get a big audience. We use our content and our brand to acquire a big audience, and then we sell that audience to advertisers. And, you know, the old way of doing it was with, you know, and still in print and in broadcast, is you'll have a print ad next to content, or you'll have a television ad before content. Once we went online, we then pretty much applied the old model. Those print ads became banner ads. You know, sometimes we would force people to watch some ads before they could see the content. And that was the traditional way, and it worked okay. What Google found was a way to solve the big problem with advertising. The big problem with advertising is that you waste most people's time. So if you're watching an ad for dentures on the Super Bowl, you know, one can assume that 90% of the people or more don't really want that ad. It's not appropriate to them, and it's wasting their time, and they're slightly annoyed by it. But that was the price you had to pay to reach such a huge audience. Now we go online, we have an infinite amount of content and an infinite amount of advertising. And if you could just match the right ad with the right content, then it wouldn't be wasting people's time. They wouldn't consider it an irritation or an interruption. Instead, it would be relevant, and they might even consider it content. And what Google was able to do by having the entire web in its servers and by having millions of advertisers and ads that could be targeted to, you know, just their words. You know, a computer can change words. You don't need an advertising company to create a new campaign for every keyword. They were able to get this perfect supply-demand matching and take advertising from an irritation into an asset. And not only that, but directly measurable, so people only paid when consumers clicked. And that was the first new advertising model we've seen in decades, and explains much of Google's success and what subsidizes all of their other work for free.
So do you have any idea of how well advertisers are doing who advertise on Google with this new formula that they're applying of matching ads and content?
You know, what we're finding is if you're actually trying to sell one specific thing, if you have a particular kind of, lawn fertilizer. And, you know, it's very easy to target the right people who are just ready, you know, either in search where they've expressed an interest, what John Battelle calls the database of intentions. They've expressed an interest in fertilizing their lawn, and pop, up comes this lawn fertilizer. That, you know, they'll click on that and that's effective. Or they'll go to some site that's all about fertilizing lawns, and you'd be amazed by how many sites there are out there where people share pictures of their lawns and people love their lawns. And there, too, it's relevant, and they click on that. And, when you're trying to sell something specifically, that's really effective. What's harder is when you're just trying to insert, a positive association with a brand into people's head, the sort of drink Coke situation. We haven't quite figured out how to do that online. And this is why YouTube is not yet a financial success and why banners continue to be sort of ignored. And, you know, why we have not yet taken the advertising model that we've seen on television and moved it entirely online. And that's a problem I think we'll probably solve over the next few years, but that's the next big wave. And for those kind of advertisers, brand advertisers, that remains an unsolved problem today.
Well, let's get to YouTube. What kind of trouble has YouTube been having in its economic model and actually getting advertisers to advertise on their site so that they can make money?
Well, you know, the beauty of YouTube is that it's YouTube. It's not, you know, a guy in suit tube. It's not Madison Avenue tube. It is by and large user-generated, user-created content, which is by definition unpredictable. And you know, it's very hard to figure out what ad's appropriate to run against a YouTube video. If I'm watching my favorite soldering tutorials, and yes, they're thrilling to me and thrilling to no one else. But that's the beauty of YouTube. Or if you're watching skateboarding videos, or you know the canonical cat on a cat tricks, what's the right ad to put against that? Does that reflect who people are? Does it reflect what they're interested in at that moment? You know, does it sort of show the brand in a good light? We have not figured out how to generate video ads on the same scale as text ads. Let's say that there are 10,000 different kind of genres on YouTube, and you wanted to customize your McDonald's ads appropriately for each one. How would you do that? How would you make that many videos? How would you have any way of knowing whether it sort of meshed with the content or just looked incredibly inappropriate? And until we figure that out, I think advertisers are rightly worried that it's going to cast their brand in the wrong light. And as a result, YouTube is by and large not an effective advertising platform and doesn't make money for Google.
You know, you're talking about how the old model of advertising hasn't really worked on the web. We just kind of put ads or banner ads on the site. There's a lot of video sites now where before you watch the video that you want to see, you watch the mandatory ad, and it's maybe 20 seconds or something, but it's a video ad, and you have to watch it before you get in the door to see the video that you've come to see. What kind of feedback are you getting on those kinds of mandatory viewing ads?
Well, this is the big question. You know, what does the Google generation want with their content? You know, the old model was they watched the ads because they had no choice. Then they had TiVo and they could fast forward through the ads, but they still had to actively do so. Now, for the first time, they can just go elsewhere. You know, there's an infinite amount of videos out there, and we're about to test the patience of the generation that's growing up in the YouTube age. Clearly, 30 seconds is too long. And the question is 15 seconds too long? How about 7 seconds? You know, if the ad comes at the end, will people watch that? Will they stick around for that? How about if the ad came, you know, as a bar underneath? And every possible experiment with video ads online is going to be done over the next few years. This is the big experiment. The big test of, you know, this wave of the internet is, okay, Google has shown that it's an effective advertising vehicle. YouTube has shown that it's an effective content vehicle. You know, the consumers want this. The audience is flocking to it. You know, check. That's the first test in a media model. The next test is this actually competition for television? As you know, can advertisers find a way to do this? And I think what they're going to end up having to do is to invent a new kind of advertisement, not just a television ad repurposed online, not just a print ad repurposed into a banner, but something new, interactive, engaging, fun. It's going to be hard work, and that's why we haven't seen it yet. It's because this always happens. With every new medium, you start by copying, you know, the old one. So television was, you know, radio with pictures, and the original web was just print, online. So I think this is early days yet, and in the next decade, I'm sure that we'll figure it out because, you know, advertising always goes where the audience is, and the audience has already made their move.
In your book, Free, you mentioned that Craigslist, which has all these free classified ads, has helped either put out of business or diminish the size of a lot of newspapers that rely on classified ads for revenue. But Craigslist itself, you point out in your book, generates just enough profit to pay the server costs and the salaries of a few dozen staff. And so the paradox here to me is that you have all these like local papers that are struggling in part because of things like Craigslist, But Craigslist itself, it seems in some ways utopian to have this kind of free listing. But at the same time, it's so centralized. It's like a group of 12 people, as opposed to this network of newspapers around the country.
Yeah. Well, Craigslist is fascinating. I think the fact that their little icon is a peace symbol should tell you a lot. I mean, I think what you're seeing with Craigslist is you know, some unambiguous goods and some things that are really worrying. And you point out a few of them. You know, one of them is that they, quote unquote, you know, demonetized the newspaper classified business without they traded, you know, pennies for dollars. So where did that money go? Where did that value go? And the answer is kind of went to all of us. We all saved, a few bucks when we posted our classified ads, and perhaps we got a slightly higher price or a quicker sale because of the volume of people that go through Craigslist. So what we saw is a kind of it wasn't a transfer of wealth from newspapers to Craigslist. It was a transfer of wealth from newspapers to all of us in ways that are really hard to measure. But I think most people who use Craigslist think it is kind of an unambiguous good. But the social costs of what happened to the journalism and to those institutions that, you know, once did a pretty good job of covering the news have not yet been recorded. This is the price that will someday be paid. And we're trying to figure out, you know, is that a net positive or a net negative? And then you have the fact that Craigslist is itself a very centralized organization and with a sort of a 1990s style website and some pretty limited sense of what people can do with it. Craigslist is not as open as, for example, Twitter is. And, you know, one could sort of see an irony in the fact that Craigslist, the premium on openness and egalitarianism, has also created a very controlled and almost monopolistic, marketplace over what used to be the classified ads business.
Getting back to media, do you want journalism to be the job of amateurs? With all due respect, amateurs aren't going to go to, who's going to go to Iraq to cover the wars? And so many newspapers have shut down their foreign bureaus. There are so few reporters now, you know, covering the war in Afghanistan, covering what's going on now in Iraq, now that we've withdrawn our forces, you know, from the cities. Covering local city halls, there's fewer reporters. I personally think that's a real problem. And I think a lot of people do too, but it's hard to tell what to do about it.
Well, this is my business. You know, this is what we experience every day as well. I pay, you know, writers $3 a word or sometimes, and we're competing with people who write for free. I think what's going to happen is it's going to be a hybrid. I think that, you know, that professional journalists are going to continue to cover the things that require the real depth and engagement and the hard stuff, the Iraqs, the investigative reporting, you know, much political reporting. The problem with journalism we're now realizing was not that we didn't do a good job. It wasn't an era of commission, as they say. It was the era of omission. There were so many things we didn't cover because there weren't enough of us and you couldn't make money from covering, you know, the local soccer teams. I think what we're going to find is that the amateurs and the professionals are going to find the relative place. You're going to have a hybrid world where amateurs cover, you know, the narrow, the niche, the subject they know really well, their own world, their own profession, their own passions. And the professionals cover the things that we do best, where the long form, the narrative, the investigative, the embedded, all those things that we as institutions can pay for, you know, continue to stand out. You know, what's clear is that all of our jobs is to add value to the internet one way or another. We need to do something the internet can't do for itself. We used to do it all. You know, if it wasn't in the paper, it wasn't news. Now there's lots of people. You know, news is what matters to you and that you talk about and pass along. Sometimes that's national, international, political, and sometimes that's local. And the question is, can the amateurs do the fine-grained, the narrow-gauge news driven by their own passions, whereas we professionals do the broader, the mass, the more global, in some senses, harder news. And we get paid for it while they do it for free.
Let's look at your model at Wired. You've been thinking so much about the impact of the internet and the free economy on newspapers and magazines. How do you feel you've been most affected at Wired, which you've been editor-in-chief at since, was it 2001?
Yeah. So, we're right in the middle of this. I mean, the ironies of my life are abound. You know, my last book was about the sort of, you know, the end of the monopoly of the blockbuster and the rise of the niche. And, you know, I work for Condé Nast, one of the biggest publishers in America, and my book is published by Disney. You know, by night, I'm all about the little guy and the long tail and the incredible narrowness of consumer attention. And by day, I do mass media and the traditional way. With the magazine and the website, what we found is that the first thing is just take the magazine. What is the role of a magazine in this age? And people ask me all the time, is print dead? And what we're now starting to get better at is sort of realizing that there's no one kind of print. There's newspapers, there's weeklies, there's monthlies, there's trade magazines, there's general interest ones, and then there's books on the far end. And some forms of print are clearly dead. You know, it is very hard to imagine the traditional, city newspaper remaining as it is, forevermore. Many will go bust over the next year or two. Other forms of print, like the physical book, seem alive and well, despite the fact that there are Kindles and e-books. It seems like the physical book, it's sitting on your shelf, being able to flip through it to give as a gift. That still seems to have value in an internet age. Whereas, yesterday's news, printed on newsprint, we're seeing a generation say, I'd rather see it online 18 hours earlier without leaving ink on the fingers. As a monthly magazine, we wrestle with this. What are we doing that the internet can't do? And we happen to be in a special class where we have 8,000 word long form stories and photography and design, and we package this all up together in something that doesn't really work well online. But if you were to invent a device tomorrow that allows us to package ideas with this same combination of visual and photographic and design and narrative and distribute it electronically, we will stop killing trees overnight. Now, that device doesn't exist yet, but it will.
You tell a really interesting story in your book, and this relates to advertising, about a friend from Google who visited you at Wired magazine. And you were talking about that impermeable wall between advertising and editorial at your magazine. And this is something that's cherished as one of the most important values in print journalism and in broadcasting, too, that impermeable wall between advertising and editorial, so that whoever's advertising isn't affecting what you write about, what you put on the air, or what you have to say about it. And your friend from Google was kind of astonished. Would you tell the story?
Yeah, it's the church and state divide, the Chinese wall between ads and editors is so sacred to traditional journalism. We keep ads apart. So we don't put the Ford ad next to the cars. We don't put the Sony ad next to the review of the Sony gadgets. And we keep them on the wall. We show how that we keep them, 7 pages apart or on the other side of the magazine. And my friend from Google just sat there with his jaw on the floor. He says, "You're joking." You realize, of course, we do just the opposite. We put the Sony ad right next to the Sony review. We put the Ford ad next to the Ford review. That's called relevance. That's what people want. And, there's only two ways to look at this. Either, there's been a change in people's perceptions of trust in media, and that they decided they trust software algorithms more than people, or possibly we were wrong all along, that people did want their ads next to their content, and that this Chinese wall, this church and state thing that we set up, was largely to reassure ourselves that we weren't being corrupted, rather than satisfy marketplace demand.
Though I should say for most places that church and state wall is in the office, and I mean, I guess what I mean by that is in the auto section of the newspaper, you're going to see car ads. And in the entertainment section, you're going to be seeing ads for movies. So, traditionally, there has been that connection between where the ads are and the content.
The general rule has been you don't put them right next to each other for fear that people will think that the ad influenced the content. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens with online is that because I think it's going to take a decade to figure out whether this is true or not, but it may be that because software is putting the ad next to the content, there's not the same assumption that somebody has been corrupted, that the content has been affected by that software decision to put the ad there. I think it's yet another of those paradoxes that challenge our assumptions about media, about trust, about how people feel about the content they read, and about why they trust what they read. And I suspect we're going to be rethinking everything in the next few decades, and a lot of the old rules are going to be thrown right out the window.
I feel like I should ask you this. You've explained it already, but not all of our listeners have heard it. There were articles about how, you know, accusing you of plagiarism, of taking things nearly word for word from Wikipedia and using it in your book. You've explained it in print, but I'm going to ask you for a very brief explanation now so our listeners who didn't read your explanation can hear it.
Sure. You know, there's a big controversy over whether Wikipedia should be cited and how it should be cited. And I actually believe it should be used in books. And, you know, the question is how to cite it. And late in the day, I objected to the usual form of citing URLs with timestamps and all that stuff and petulantly removed my notes and then did a very, very bad job of reintegrating it all in the 11th hour into the text itself. So, you know, I think it's that sloppiness, and we fixed that in the digital editions and in the next printing. But the big question is, you know, how should Wikipedia be integrated into scholarship, into writing going forward? And, you know, I think that's an unsolved question because the Wikipedia entries change and the authorship is diffuse. But I do think we should find a way, and I do believe in citing Wikipedia, well and often, and recognizing how much scholarship and thought you can actually find there as long as you check the sources.
I want to change the subject here. In your acknowledgments, you mentioned that during the period you were writing this book, you had some kind of condition that was finally diagnosed as Lyme disease and then was undiagnosed as Lyme disease. First of all, are you all better now?
Yeah, you know, thank you for bringing that up. This was the last 2 years of my life have been really sort of colored by this. Amy Tan famously had Lyme disease, and she was diagnosed and was treated well. Lyme is very hard to diagnose, and there are Lyme specialists who will diagnose you. Basically, I was sort of falling to pieces. I had neurological issues, etc. Got a Lyme's diagnosis, was treated for nearly 2 years with antibiotics, and then I went to the Mayo and got a full workup, and they said, you know, we don't think you have it. I'm not sure whether you ever had it. We think you should stop taking antibiotics. And so I did, and now I'm better. But there's a lot of medicine out there which is in the gray zone. You can't detect the diseases directly. You're going off the symptoms. You get pulled into these whirlpools of online communities who feel, you know, who are shaking the fist against the medical establishment. Then you have the medical establishment who thinks that these are, you know, that there's much bad advice being given. And I got pulled into that world and came out 2 years later feeling okay and much better, but, you know, just genuinely confused about what happens to most people when they have a condition that doesn't fit into the usual definitions of the medical establishment, and how they do take matters into their own hands without getting drawn into, you know, the dark side of, you know, self-treatment and misinformation.
The internet's a strange place when you're not feeling well. If you want to research your symptoms, you can find some sites that are incredibly helpful and others that will just scare the heck out of you, probably unnecessarily. Did you find that?
This used to be called medical student syndrome. I did. I think, and this is something that I'm sure everyone has experience with, when you Google your symptoms, you know, you've suddenly discovered that you've got it all.
Right.
And it just gets worse and worse. And, this is another one of these problems where the explosion of information and the disintermediation, the sort of the lack of the trusted intermediaries. We're now getting the information raw, even though we're not really competent to analyze it ourselves. We can't read those medical articles and weigh them properly. And it's going to get worse before it gets better, I think. We are, you know, as healthcare becomes a bigger and bigger issue, and more of us feel somewhat underserved by the healthcare establishment and want to take matters into our own hands, we're going to go down the rabbit hole, just as I did. And hopefully, you know, there will be services that emerge that allow us to kind of come out and get the equivalent of medical advice without, necessarily having a doctor in front of us. But right now, it's very easy to catastrophize. It's very easy to
exactly.
drive yourself
right word.
Crazy.
Right word.
Yeah.
Did you get a diagnosis ever?
You know, it's funny. I never did. I went into the Mayo Clinic with a diagnosis of Lyme and came out with no diagnosis at all. And, you know, I actually felt better about it. They do such a kind of a thorough workup of all of you. They say, well, you know, you don't have X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z is what I'd been obsessing over the last year. And just to have someone someone just take those off the table, even though I don't have a diagnosis. Basically, I have now neurological damage, which will be with me forever, but that's fine. I can live with that. I've always taken my health for granted. And to have not only to be able to not know that you'll be able to do the impossible and rise to the occasion, but also in the back of your mind to have sort of taken yourself to the dark side, to have taken yourself to the very worst, and just and be asking be looking at your life insurance and things like that. It is. I now have great insight and empathy for those who really are sick, and I found it was probably the most difficult thing I've struggled with. It's the internet can take you to a very dark place.
Yeah, well, you really did go to the dark side, it sounds like, and I'm glad that you came back. So good luck with your health. It sounds like that's under control if I'm hearing you correctly. And thank you so much for your explanations of some of the things going on the internet. Thank you very much and be well.
Thank you, Terry. It's a real pleasure.
Chris Anderson is the editor-in-chief of Wired and author of the new book, Free. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has been visiting and revisiting a new exhibition of art from 16th century Venice, when it was an international power, a wealthy and glamorous center of art and commerce at the crossroads of Europe and Asia Minor. Lloyd says it's more than just an art history lesson.
The subtitle of the thrilling new exhibition at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts is Rivals in Renaissance Venice. The premise of the show is that the three greatest artists of 16th century Venice, Titian, Tintoretto, and Veronese, not only knew but learned from and even imitated each other. Titian was the old master and painted into his late 80s. The younger Tintoretto was one of Titian's students, but Titian, perhaps threatened by his student's brash talent, turned against him and instead championed the even younger Veronese. The major selling point of this show is the interrelationship among these artists. We have, in some cases, our very first chance to compare side by side their different versions of the same subjects, religious scenes, portraits, nudes. Titian's psychological profundity and structural mastery are set against both Tintoretto's dark and sometimes even vulgar theatricality and Veronese's more pastel elegance and refined sentiment, which can sometimes turn merely decorative and sentimental. It's a fascinating study. Curator Frederick Ilchman managed to get the major museums of Paris, London, Madrid, Florence, Vienna, New York, and Washington, many smaller out-of-the-way institutions, and even some private collectors to lend their masterpieces. Given skyrocketing insurance and the increasing costs and risks of long-distance transportation, shows on this level will surely get rarer and rarer. The comparisons are eye-opening, but I'm not really sure they're the soul of this exhibit. For me, the real joy is not the art history lesson, but the spectacular paintings themselves, to which each artist fully brings his own identity. Titian was one of the first artists to use canvas instead of wood for his larger commissions, which gave him and his followers a new way to move paint around a surface, and so allowed for a greater sensuousness of textures, especially in the depiction of both cloth and skin, human and animal. Surface becomes seduction. Tintoretto's ravishing Susanna and the Elders shows the blinding white flesh of the naked Susanna, her left leg dipping into a pool, her mirror and exotic toiletries laid out before her, while two dirty old men crouch behind a hedge to sneak a peek. Is Tintoretto suggesting that each of us onlookers is like those dirty old men? Or the artist himself? His rakish, early self-portrait suggests that that's exactly the kind of person he might become. Yet his world-weary late self-portrait, the last painting in the show, suggests that his life didn't at all turn out that way. The great Veronese in the show is his famous allegorical Venus and Mars united by love, a dazzling image of the triumph of love over war. The legs of the two gods being bound by Cupid as Venus squeezes drops of milk from her breast. Then there are the Titians, the sweet, rustic Virgin Marys, one of them with a rabbit in his early paintings. The alluring, mythological Titian blonde nudes. The sinister Pope, who clearly doesn't trust anyone. The young Ranuccio Farnese, one of the great portraits of a child, whose lavish, oversized clothing and codpiece this innocent will surely grow into all too soon. Titian actually paints himself into his late religious paintings, as a witness to Christ's entombment and as the suffering Saint Jerome at the foot of a cross. What is the mysterious connection between being an artist and religious devotion? And there's Titian's even more mysterious painting of a strange child. Is it the baby Bacchus carrying a bunch of grapes in his skirt? Hugging a noble dog that's standing careful guard over a mother dog nursing her puppies. All of them set against a turbulent, swirling, gorgeously painted landscape. What's this painting about? Do any of the other rooms of painting supply a hint? Or is this the real mystery of art, beyond art history, beyond explanation, yet utterly mesmerizing, moving, and unforgettable?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed Titian, Tintoretto, Veronese, Rivals in Renaissance Venice, which will be at Boston's Museum of Fine Art through August 16th before it moves to the Louvre Museum in Paris. Singer Tony Bennett and jazz pianist Bill Evans recorded two albums together for different labels in the mid-1970s. Those sides have now been brought together, along with the complete alternate takes from those sessions. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review.
And though from Italy I lied to you prettily, why think of me bitterly? You know that I'm true, except now and then in Rome. I get that old yen in Rome, and naturally when in Rome, I do as the Romans do.
Last Valentine's Day, had dinner at a little Italian restaurant in Brooklyn. Nice place. Very good food, excellent service, and a CD of Tony Bennett singing Ellington playing softly in the background. Tony Bennett makes perfect background music because even at low volume, you can hear every word. The man is a natural belter. So his mid-70s duo with pianist Bill Evans might seem a bit of a mismatch, Evans being a quiet master of understatement, as on Miles Davis's Kinda Blue.
Where has the time all gone to? Haven't done half the things we want to. Oh, well, we'll catch up some other time.
No problems there. The singer and pianist may be an odd couple, but they click. That's not the version of Some Other Time originally released. It's one of the alternate takes that make up half the new, complete Tony Bennett, Bill Evans recordings on two CDs. Evans and Bennett recorded over 4 days in 1975 and again in 76 with minimal preparation in the studio. The alternate takes on the second disc never sound like rehearsals or like the stentorian singer and subtle pianist struggle to meet in the middle. They sound comfortable from the first, and the differences between two takes of the same song are like catching the duo on different nights of a club engagement. The arc of a tune stays the same, although details change.
You don't know how lips hurt until you've kissed and had to pay the cost. Until you flipped your heart and you have lost, you don't know what love is. Do you know how a lost heart feels? The thought of reminiscing.
For the take originally released, Bennett changes his phrasing a bit. He's snappier on the word reminiscing, and Bill Evans gives him a wider berth to ease into the tune's bridge, right here.
Do you know how a lost heart feels? The thought of reminiscing. And our lips that taste of tears lose their taste for kissing. You don't know how hearts burn for love.
Okay, so Tony Bennett can tone down his natural exuberance. He practically whispers, "You must believe in spring," although he sounds like he's consciously holding back. Even on tunes he starts quietly, he may ratchet it up before the end. Bennett's imposing presence doesn't always leave room for all the nuances of touch and harmony Bill Evans is capable of. But the pianist graciously plays second banana and gets a solo feature as his reward. Evans hadn't worked with so many singers, but he recorded two-thirds of these mostly classic tunes before, including a couple he'd written and some that got heavy play in his trios. Once in a while, some wiseacre will claim Bill Evans was a glorified cocktail pianist. Here he plays saloon piano for real and gives a strong singer support he could count on. Lucky Tony.
Chose me from all the crowd. There's no other guy I'd rather be. Oh, I could laugh out loud. I'm so lucky to be me.
Kevin Whitehead is currently on leave from teaching at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com.
The touch of your lips upon my brow, your lips that are cool and sweet, such tenderness lies in their soft caress. My heart forgets to beat.
You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anna Maria Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
The touch of your lips upon my brow, your lips that are cool and sweet, such tenderness lies in their soft caress. My heart forgets to beat. The touch of your hands upon my head, The love in your eyes a shine. And now at last the moment divine, the touch of your lips on mine.